Alternative to talk back
on FBI 94.5.
Hello and welcome to the show where we don't actually have a joke for the Andrew because AH is away this week. My name is Heidi Pett and this week I'm joined live in the studio by Matt Bannum.
Hello. Hello, how are you?
Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Now, on the show this week, James Colley will be asking a couple of questions about exactly how true blue the Aussie mining industry is, which is kind of pertinent on the day that Clive Palmer just spent so much more in advertising than possibly anyone else ever for the WA election. We've also got Bart Denaro asking some questions about what happens when you hand over the administration of your asylum seeker offshore processing centres to a profit-driven private company. And we'll also be talking about the economics of seeking asylum. But really excitingly, we've got Mike Isaacs, who will be joining us in the studio in about 5 minutes. So if you've ever wondered what life is really like on our processing centre on Nauru, Mike Isaacs is your man. He spent 18 months there working for the Salvation Army. That's up next. We've got heaps of great Australian music to play on the show. What do we got, Matt?
First up is ex-Adelaide band Hit the Jackpot with a song called King of the Pool. It's a good song.
Thank you.
You're listening to Backchat on FBI Radio. That's a band out of Adelaide called Hit the Jackpot with a song from their Soul Money Gang Vibe EP. I've got Matt Banham joining me in the studio today, and we've also got Mark Isaacs. Now, look, after 100 days without the arrival of an asylum seeker boat on Australian shores, which just happened to coincide with the monsoon season, I don't know, Prime Minister Tony Abbott claimed victory this week. He had stopped the boats. Now, the government has seemingly turned the whole issue into a footy match, complete with scoreboards, banners, slogans, and now a victory, a winner.
Well, was he wearing like a fighter, a war suit or something, standing on a boat like George Bush did when he declared victory?
Look, I'm not sure. There was probably a high-vis vest or a hard hat involved somewhere along the line. But the thing is that while these boats are being diverted elsewhere, thousands of asylum seekers do remain in detention centres across Australia and throughout the Pacific region. Now, the huge problem with that, of course, is that the treatment of those asylum seekers, it's not great. The conditions aren't great. Now, for a first-hand account of what life is like in a detention centre, we've got Mark Isaacs in the studio. Now, Mark is the author behind The Undesirables, which is a just-published book about his experiences as a Salvation Army worker on Nauru. What were you thinking when you decided to go and work on Nauru? What were you expecting?
I guess I didn't really know what to expect because we weren't given any kind of training and I don't think the organisation really knew what to expect going over there. But I went over there with a keen interest to help asylum seekers, but also a curiosity as to what exactly this was going to look like, this policy, and a sense of adventure of thinking, yeah, let's go out there and see this, let's see immigration history.
So you went there with kind of an altruistic motive, thinking I'm going to go and work for the Salvation Army, I'll improve conditions for the people who unfortunately are in this offshore centre, but maybe I can make it a little bit easier. How did that go?
Well, that was definitely the intention for a lot of my colleagues and myself. But in reality, when you get over to Nauru and you're placed in this policy called No Advantage, the idea behind No Advantage and the whole goal behind No Advantage is to deter asylum seekers from getting on boats and coming to Australia. And when you consider that most of these people, 90% of these people who are, by the statistics say that are refugees, get on these boats because they're fleeing from war, persecution, fear of death, fear of torture. It's got to take something very severe to deter them from getting on these boats. And so to arrive in a camp with that is the goal, and that is essentially what they're trying to achieve, well, then it's got to be a pretty awful place.
What was the camp actually like?
So the camp is situated on this very small island of Nauru, and I think it's important to note that the island is purposefully remote, and it's so far from anything that when you actually land on the island, you think you're landing on water. That was actually one of the asylum seekers described to me. And around the edges of the island, it's paradise isles and tropical beaches, and then in the centre, it's this mined out phosphate rock, and that's where the camp's kept. And it's extremely hot. Within the tents that the men were housed in and are now housed in again, it reaches 50 degrees Celsius.
Wow.
In the wet season, the camp floods. And so up to ankle, knee height. The men slept on stretcher beds, on pallet floorboards, and there was nothing to do. And so all the physical conditions are hard, but then the psychological conditions of indefinite detention, which is sitting every day waiting for a decision to be made with no idea when you can leave or what will happen to you when you leave, on top of all thinking of your families in your home countries and all the traumas that you've suffered yourself, It's a very, very difficult place to live.
So working for the Salvation Army, what kind of work were you doing?
Again, going over there, we had no training, no job description, no mission brief. So essentially, we were told, what we were actually told was to go out and help the men. And when you put in context of the No Advantage policy and all these men's traumas and everything I've just described, there's not much you can really do to help them. Having said that, the people I worked with, we did as much as we could, and we did English classes, and we talked to them and just talked about their stories and became their friends in a way, because that was all we could do. And what I did was immediately notice that there was a distinct lack of activities and exercise routines and just things to occupy their minds to, to separate themselves from the awfulness of the camp and give them something to think about and do outside of just worrying about their lives. And so I set up a recreation program that involved excursions out of the camp and cricket competitions and football competitions and music concerts and things like that.
Awesome. Did the asylum seekers ask you questions about their status and things like that? Were they trying to get answers from you?
Yeah, all the time. Yeah. I mean, we were the first point of contact. So any questions, any issues, anything that they thought about, they raised with us first, because we were always, I guess, we were the kind face that they would address, and then we would pass on their request to the Department of Immigration or to the security. And yeah, every day, you know, what's happening to us? Why are we here? What are we doing here? When can we leave? And all questions that we couldn't answer.
Yeah.
One of the things that you wrote about in The Undesirables was the attitude of the security staff, and you're saying you found that quite shocking.
What's interesting about the Wilson Security, and which has now been amalgamated into the Transfield company, which runs the camp, is that you had a wide range of people, and you had security, people from private security, you had people from the Defence Force, you had people from police forces, you had people from mental health services, and some of the men had an extreme amount of care for the men and did their utmost to help these guys. And others agreed with the policy and thought that they were, you know, these people deserved what they got, and, you know, would take imaginary sniper rifles and pretend to shoot them. One of the men who worked there, racially abused in a horrific manner, one of the men I worked with who was Sri Lankan. So you had a whole wide range. But I think what's worrying for me about the security company is that they have a goal and they have a reason why they're there, and that's to restrict the men as much as possible. And they, in my opinion, the security company was more valued their goals and their company more than the safety of the men, and would... a lot of the time, express events that would happen that would, in a way, that would benefit the company rather than tell the truth of what happened.
So saying when reporting incidents of, you know, self-harm or any violence or anything like that, they wouldn't report them fully as you saw them happen?
It was more to do with when it came into question their men's integrity. So, for instance, one Tamil man came out of an incident of a hanging or attempted hanging, attempted suicide, and he had blood all over his nose and claimed that he was punched by the guards. And the unanimous report from the guards was that he punched himself in the face.
That's a good one.
Mm. Wow. So you've written a book about the whole thing. And what's been the reaction? Have you had any reaction from the government about your book at all?
I think thus far the government haven't replied to me or made any kind of comment about my book, and I would assume that's because any kind of attention that would give this book more publicity is in their eyes detrimental to their cause, because I don't think there's too much they can really argue with what I've written, because essentially it's the truth. But from the public, I've received a lot of good feedback, wide range of feedback. From the colleagues I worked with, they expressed their gratitude and their belief that it reflected everything that they witnessed. And from the asylum seekers, it was definitely gratitude and amazement that someone would go out and do this for them.
Have you managed to keep in contact with any of the asylum seekers that you worked with? Have any been granted refugee status and moved to the mainland?
So not one of the men that I worked with, and not one of the people that who arrived in Australia since the No Advantage policy was introduced has been processed as a refugee. And that's one of the biggest worries about this system, is that these people aren't being processed, so there's no way you can tell if they're refugees or not. The majority of men have been moved from Nauru, despite the government claiming that no man who arrived in Nauru would ever get to Australia. The majority of the men I worked with have been placed on bridging visas in Australia, and I've been in a lot of contact with them. There's a very small amount of men who were indicted in the July riots in 2013 and are facing charges in Nauru, despite them claiming that they had no involvement in the riots and having not given proper access to legal representation. And the most recent news is that the only magistrate on the island of Nauru was sacked and deported because he tried to stop the court case being held within the detention centre, secret away from the media. And when he did that, they sacked him and deported him. So these small amount of men, and they're main characters in the book and very good friends of mine, And I believe that they would have no involvement in this riot because they didn't have any other riot before that. They are now facing charges that could potentially put them in prison in Nauru, never to be allowed to be a refugee, and it doesn't seem like there's any kind of fair trial going on.
Mark Isaacs, thank you so much for joining us on Backchat, and we'll post a link on the Facebook page if you are interested in finding out more about Mark, his experiences, or indeed the book. Thank you very much for joining us. My name is Heidi Pett. Matt Banham is co-hosting on this show today. This is a song from King Tears Mortuary. Now, coming up just after this, we're actually going to hear a little bit more about Australia's offshore detention centres. But Dinaro has had a bit of a look into what happens when you do contract a private company to take care of government business.
Hello. Hey there. You're listening to FBI. This is Backchat. And we just heard from King Tears Mortuary, Sydney band, who've got a new 7-inch coming out soon, which has a really funny name, but I can't remember the name. But if you heard it, you would laugh.
You can check out all the playlists online and we'll figure out what the name of that one is and put it on the program page, fbiradio.com/backchat. My name is Heidi Pett. Matt Banham is filling in for A.H. Cayley this week. And we've just had Mark Isaacs in the studio talking about his experiences working on our offshore detention centre in Nauru for about 9 months. Now, when the Biennale of Sydney severed its ties with Transfield because of their involvement in running Australia's offshore mandatory detention centres, the entrenched government practice of outsourcing these operations was finally dragged out into the light, and we asked a couple of questions about it. Now, Backchat contributor Bart Dinaro has looked into the bipartisan pastime of privatising asylum seeker detention.
The government this week has been brandishing the phrase 100 days without a boat arrival like a smug cat with a dead rat in its mouth. What about the more important question of how many boats have been turned back? Scott?
Well, look, I'll refer people to the other reports that are out there. I'm not going to go into that detail.
All right, Minister, you make a strong point there. And that point is mission accomplished. So with the Coalition's goal of stopping the boats pretty much an awesome reality by now, it's time we reflected on how a small nation under siege managed to repel such an overwhelming invading force. How did we do it? With the help of some friendly transnational corporations, that's how.
One of the things that many Australians aren't aware of, and this has been going on now for well over a decade, is the fact that our detention centres, both onshore and offshore, are run by private corporations.
That's Anthony Lowenstein.
My name is Anthony Lowenstein. I'm a Sydney-based independent journalist, author and filmmaker.
In his book, Prophets of Doom, he explores the implications of attaching a profit motive to the administration of detention operations.
because these companies are running these centres with the most vulnerable people imaginable, their aim is to turn a profit, which is what capitalism is, but they're often doing that at the expense of people's rights, both the staff and also the detainees themselves. So training is incredibly poor, mental health is incredibly poor of the staff who work there, as well as the detainees.
Okay, so before we get into the implications of all this wonderful capitalism, let's start at the why. Why have successive governments been so keen to outsource?
I think it's twofold. There's one ideological and one practical. Ideological is, in the last 30 or so years, it's pretty much started in the US and the UK under President Reagan and Prime Minister Thatcher, where there was a belief that key services that used to be run by the state should be outsourced to private corporations. The argument behind that at the time was that it made it far more efficient and cheaper. In Australia, I think a decision was made many years ago to outsource detention centres because it made the government, in its own mind, less responsible for what happened inside those centres. When something goes wrong or there's a riot, the government blames the service provider, the private company, and the private company blames the government. This is a perfect arrangement. What you see in theory is a great deal of accountability, checks and balances. In practice, these are rarely enforced.
In 2005, Labor opposition spokesman for immigration, Tony Burke, said this about Howard's policy of outsourcing immigration detention to the private sector.
There's been an undue emphasis on containment and not enough concern about care. You can only get those clear lines of responsibility if you have government-run centres. You shouldn't have a situation where the level of supervision and the standard of care has anything to do with the private profits of an offshore company.
What followed was 6 years of continued privatised detention under Labor. Then, in the first few torrid months of coalition rule, we saw the tragic death of Reza Barati, a detainee on Manus Island. And according to Anthony, the opposition has been underwhelming.
The Labor Party's response wasn't to show outrage about the policy. It was to say, we're proud of the policy, we're proud of PNG, we're proud of Manus Island, what we set up under our watch. We're disappointed that the Liberal government has not managed it properly. That's the opposition in this country. It doesn't really matter who's in charge in Canberra. They will throw any amount of money to make sure the system remains privatised and incredibly secret. And if you keep journalists out of the picture, you don't make it very easy through freedom of information to get information. Let's not forget, when it's a private corporation, FOI is irrelevant. They're not public organisations. So to get detailed information about how much money they're making, why they're making the money, how this is working, the only way it's going to happen, really, because you're not going to get that from an official spokesperson, are through leaks.
While we were in detention, we made many requests to meet the media.
Ramesh Fernandez is a refugee, writer, ex-detainee and CEO of RISE, the first asylum seeker advocacy organisation to be run exclusively by asylum seekers and ex-detainees.
So when we request to meet the media from the people who are running private corporates, they say like, oh, we are not authorized to do that by the Department of Immigration. And then when we request from the Department of Immigration, oh, it's not up to us, that responsibility is to the people who are managing.
Am I the only one noticing a trend developing here? And what about those Reaganomic claims of privatised efficiency? When Kevin Rudd awarded Serco the contract to run Australia's detention centres in 2009, it was worth about $370 million. But as the boat arrivals began to surge, the system couldn't handle it, and within 3 years, the contract had blown out to over $1 billion. Yes, more refugees equal more costs, but $1 billion seems like a lot to pay for a bunch of squalid hellholes.
Now, the reason that that's happening is that the company is saying to the government, all these people are coming, we need to manage these people, we need to house them, feed them. And the problem was that on Christmas Island, for example, the centre that was set up, and I visited there, it's basically a high-security prison. Senior managers are telling managers at detention centres themselves, do not report breaches, which happen all the time, because if you report them, you're going to get in trouble and they're going to get fined by the government. If the government themselves, who are the ones who are supposed to be managing the contract, don't actually enforce it, then ultimately there's kind of a culture in there of impunity.
One of Anthony's sources inside Serco told him that both the company and the immigration department were in chaos, unable to handle the numbers. But the corporation continued reducing staff to bolster their profit margins. With governments more interested in maintaining deniability than enforcing humanitarian standards, that a corporate culture of underreporting and cost-cutting has developed is hardly surprising. But that ain't the half of it.
I had internal documents, and actually he wasn't a former Serco manager. He's actually still a current Serco manager, who is saying that the corporation is deliberately exaggerating the amount of money they need. The government is seemingly happy to do so, and I gave the example in the book, companies deliberately allowing situations to get out of control.
That's deliberately allowing situations to get out of control.
The reason they're doing that, it's not a conspiracy theory, it was said by senior managers themselves, that this is happening because then the corporation goes to the government and says, we need more money. We need more support. We need somehow to manage this problem that you, in your view, have created.
It's all pretty hard to verify, precisely because information is so tightly controlled. This is a confidential source of Anthony's, but conspiracy theory or not, a situation in which dangerous incidents may be providing justification for companies to request more money is one worth examining. Not only does letting things get out of hand lead to more government money in the direct way Anthony describes, it also serves to slow down the processing of asylum seekers' claims, keeping the centres fuller for longer. Fuller of freshly traumatised detainees and staff, making further incidents even more likely. Yep, stalling by any means available is the name of the game, because the last thing these corporations want is an empty centre.
They don't want to let it go. The people who run these camps, they don't want to close it down. While I was in detention centres, when there is a need, a medical need or any sort of welfare needs, when I go and ask a security guard, they say like, oh, we are not authorised to do that because the government not now letting you to take such services. And then when I question the immigration, they say like, oh, it's not from us. It's the people who are running the detention centres. So it's just like become a football which gets kicked from both ends. The people who have medical health issues, they get transferred to mainland and they will be kept for a while until they get a little bit better and they will be sent back to the offshore. And then once they get back to the offshore, after a while they will have the same problem and a few months later they will fly back to mainland and then after that, a few months later they will send back to Christmas Island or any other offshore detention center. So it's just like the devil game between the government and the private entities who are running the detention centers.
The most seductive aspect of this arrangement for both government and the corporations seems to be the fact that responsibility can remain forever unassigned. The government blames the corporation for riots and deaths, and the corporation blames the government for under-resourcing, and in the meantime, the whole process blows out. But where does responsibility actually lie? Can we really blame the corporation, given that the government is creating the market and the conditions that permit such corporate behaviour? Isn't this just companies doing what companies do?
The point that I will reiterate is that this is not a regular commercial contract.
Bryn O'Brien is an international lawyer and researcher who is researching the supply and investment chains of human rights abuse. And according to her, there's plenty of blame to go around.
We have dual types of responsibility in this situation. We have the Australian government, which is responsible primarily for the policy and the decisions to offshore and detain people. But we also have corporations that are, to be quite brutally frank about it, profiting off massive systematic human rights abuse. So this is a shared responsibility. Businesses have obligations to respect human rights in their business activities that is independent of any actions of national government.
These obligations derive from international and transnational law, specifically from the UN Guiding Principles on Business and Human Rights and the OECD Guidelines on Multinational Enterprises. A quick flick through these documents makes me wonder if these companies have even heard about international law. But more importantly, has international law heard about these companies? And if so, what the hell is it waiting for?
The difficulty always with transnational and international law is in enforcement. Very difficult to enforce claims of human rights violations against business. There are some complaints mechanisms that exist, but it is difficult to hold corporations to account in a hard way.
When both sides of politics are getting off on outsourcing detention and there's effectively no way to hold anyone legally accountable for anything, What options are left for the dissenting individuals who have lost political agency? Sometimes a market-based problem calls for a market-based solution.
The value chain of mandatory detention in Australia is quite massive. If superannuation money, for example, is divested from transfer services, then we may start to see corporations acknowledging that mandatory detention isn't a good investment for them. That is where Australians who oppose detention can exert market power. They could move their super from a fund that invests in Transbuild, for example, to a fund that doesn't. And then the range of partners that the government will have to implement this abuse will decrease. There will be fewer companies that are happy to have their share price and also their reputation dragged through this policy of abuse.
Despite being labelled by some as a tantrum, the campaign of divestment is gaining momentum, with the Biennale of Sydney cutting ties with Transfield after being petitioned by a group of artists and activists to do so. Also, the Australian Services Union recently adopted a resolution calling for industry superfund HESTA to divest from Transfield and advised its 20,000 members on how to stop their super being invested with Transfield services. The paradox at the heart of privatised detention is that the government's policy goal of processing claims and getting these centres emptied runs directly counter to the corporation's profit motive. The market conditions created by the government say more detainees equals more money, more catastrophic incidents equals more money, and fewer reported breaches equal fewer fines, which equals more money. It's a noxious mix of secrecy, bipartisanship, responsibility dodging, and toothless international law that is keeping these centres opened and generating mega profits. But with super divestment as a first step, it may be these mega profits that offer those who disagree the chance to make their voices heard, if not as citizens, then as consumers.
You're listening to Backchat on FBI Radio. That story from Bart Denaro, Scott Morrison and Tony Burke were both approached for comment, but neither responded before the deadline.
Which is a huge surprise. Scott Morrison is a great friend of this show. He really loves returning our calls and writing back
he's
to our emails.
Man, very busy.
He's a very busy man.
He's got to walk the corridors scowling at people.
He has many press releases and many press conferences to attend and say not much at all. I'm sure it's a very, very taxing activity for him.
He's got to write those speeches where he says nothing all day long.
I know. Yeah. Look, I think it would actually be a really, really fun job to be Scott Morrison's speechwriter. It'd just be, when I was a kid, we used to do this thing where we'd try and get as many possible buzzwords into a speech as possible. And it was just, yeah, it was this little joke. And it was like, you get a tick for this one, you get a tick for that one, you get a tick for this one. I'm wondering if maybe in Scott Morrison's office, there's some sort of drinking game. How many times can you say that's an operational matter? Maybe that's
their excuse.
It should
be a drinking game. They'd be very drunk.
Yeah, maybe they're shit-faced all the time and that's why they can't answer any questions. Look, I don't know. You're listening to Backchat on FBI Radio. Matt Banham joins us in the studio this week, filling in for A.H. Cayley, and my name is Heidi Pett. Coming up after this, James Colley is asking a couple of questions about exactly how true blue Australia's mining industry is. And we'll be having a bit of a chat about exactly what kind of saving the government is making by denying asylum seekers access to legal aid. But this is Romy from Sweat and Regret.
Conscious and emotional reaction to personal past acts and behaviours.
Who's that chick?
Grey t-shirt on her back with the sweaty pits.
R-O-M-I, yo, it's murder.
Open up a handbag, find a spare burger.
She's the one you find asleep in the club.
Drooling on the table by the empty bottle above.
This one is for my gym bunny,
sipping on that protein.
Rome, sweat and regret, 2014.
Across the lawn, the instructor
You're listening to Backchat on FBI Radio 94.5 FM or, of course, streaming online and mobile at fbiradio.com. That was Romy with Sweat and Regret. Now, if there's an industry that's synonymous with Australian culture, it's mining. It provides the country with a ton of jobs, colourful characters like Clive Palmer and Gina Rinehart, and makes the economy look a lot better than it actually is.
But just how true blue is the Australian mining industry? Backchat contributor James Colley put on a high-vis vest, donned a hard hat, and went on a mission to find out.
Australians love a mine. We love our golden soil, but we much prefer our wealth of toil. It's just Australian. Like a cold beer, footy, and tearing apart our natural resources so they may be exported overseas for massive profits. The mining industry has long been the backbone of the Australian economy. Beloved by politicians and agoraphobics alike, nothing says good times like living in a mine. But how Australian is the mining industry? Are we talking Skippy the Bush industrialist? Or is this more of a Russell Crowe New Zealander but successful enough to be called Australian scenario? Let's find out. A report commissioned by the Greens found that 83% of Australian mines are foreign-owned, with an estimated $50 billion going offshore. The mining industry claims that even though the mines aren't Australian-owned, Australians still reap the rewards, as Gina Rinehart explains using a tone usually reserved for erotic fan fiction.
Because mines don't just sit there out in the bush, cut off from everything else. In fact, their development, construction and operations mean work and revenue to many others from every part of the country.
That would be true if this money went back to Australians. But as the ABC reported, according to an estimate by the Reserve Bank of Australia, only about half of this money is invested locally, with most heavy mining equipment being bought overseas. But it doesn't matter where the money's going. The important thing is that mining creates jobs, right? We've heard multiple times that mining is the saviour of the Australian economy. Mining dominates the news cycle like a mine dominates the stupid nature underneath it. But just how big is the mining industry? Well, according to the Bureau of Statistics, as of June 2009, the mining industry employed 135,000 people. For scale, at the same time, Australia had 10.8 million people aged 15 years or over currently working. Of that number, 11.4% or 1.3 million were in healthcare, 10.9% in retail, 9.1% in construction, and 8.4% in manufacturing. Mining forms about 1.25% of our employment, which is slightly less than the number of people working in arts and recreation. What's up? But there are jobs available and our unemployment rate is increasing, particularly youth unemployment. So why aren't people taking these jobs? Well, the problem is the majority of young unemployed people are unskilled workers, and the last unskilled worker actually needed in a mine was a canary. Unemployed skilled workers tend to be older, aged between 35 and 54, as well as married. This makes them even more likely than anyone else to want to abandon their families and flee to a mine. Am I right, fellas? No, I'm categorically wrong. As Bernard Keane points out, any benefit from higher wages families would receive from relocating to a mining area would be partially, if not entirely, negated by higher housing costs, increased cost of living, and limited access to education and healthcare. But hey, there's heaps of dirt. Everyone loves dirt, right? But say you do make the trip, what can you expect from a life in the mines? Well, you'll be working on average 44.3 hours per week, which is almost 5 hours more per week than the national full-time average. But if it's any consolation, time flies when you can't see the sun. If you're a woman, you'll be heavily in the minority, with only 9% representation in full-time workforce, and of that 9%, only 0.5% representation in management or board positions. But come on, women probably only make up 15% of the population anyway, maybe 20 pushing it, so that's fine. And the people running the mines have spoken extensively about wages being too high compared to those elsewhere in the world, meaning that it is likely that they are to be cut in the near future. But hey, even if you're only being paid Gina Rinehart's $2 a day, that's only 2 days full-time work before you can afford your morning coffee. So pick up your pick and say hi-ho, bye haters today and head for your local mine. Because what can be more Australian than actually living down under?
Thanks, James Colley. It's Backchat contributor explaining exactly how true blue the Australian mining industry is. And I guess the other thing is that, you know, they perhaps overstate their impact on the economy and perhaps overstate the number of jobs that Australians are actually employed in within the mining industry. But the other thing is that they have a fairly disproportionately enormous political influence.
Mm. They got a lot of money.
They do have a lot of money, as evidenced by Clive Palmer's Senate campaign in WA, where he outspent every single other party by hundreds of thousands of dollars.
If he doesn't get a seat, that would be... well, he's already got his seat, but if he doesn't get another couple for himself, that's probably the worst investment he would have ever made.
He's going to... Oh, look, I don't know. There is the dinosaur park and the Titanic. I'm not sure how many hundreds of thousands of dollars he threw into those.
I don't like... a lot of what Palmer does, but I really want to go to that dinosaur park. It looks amazing. I love dinosaurs.
I think that's the thing with everyone. It's like, oh, I don't really like what Clive Palmer does, but, you know, he twerked that time and he has a dinosaur park and he's building a Titanic. And he went and did that ridiculous music video on some commercial station in WA where they wrote a song for him. Yeah. And he's standing there reading out the lyrics and it's like, Palmer's worth $1 billion, so elect me, yo, pretty much. Like... which is not really all that different to what he said when he came on Backchat when we asked him, you know, why should the Australian public put their faith in you? Why should your party be elected? And he just said, well, I've made a lot of money. And it's like, I just don't know if that's really the criteria anymore. I mean, Arthur Sinodinos was about to make a lot of money and it turns out he wasn't really that fit for the Senate.
If he was to become the Prime Minister one day, would he... spend his own money to help the country out? That's one, because he could have mentions his money all the time. And there's a thing that he said the other day about climate change, how he could get a bunch of scientists together and just pay them whatever he wanted to fix any sort of problem.
But because that's how science works.
But I'm wondering if he would use his own money to fix all the problems, or if he just decided that he could use all of our money to fix all the problems.
I don't know. Look, maybe Clive Palmer would actually make a great PM because, you know, he does have all of this money. So maybe if he, because he's got so much, he wouldn't need to pull it out of public coffers and we wouldn't have this Obeid Sinodinos shit fight that's happening in New South Wales at the moment.
Clive Palmer like could king.
Just, he could just take care of all of us.
That'd be nice.
Yeah.
He looks cuddly.
You're listening to Backchat on FBI Radio. Matt Banham is filling in for AH Kaylee this morning. My name is Heidi Pat. We got a brand new one from Nathan Roche. This is Alcoholics Anonymous.
This song is so good. Just saying. Just quietly.
Just saying. Nope. So good, it doesn't want to play.
Alcoholics Anonymous, what have you done with this? Took all our bottles away. Alcoholics Anonymous said you would tell us how we expected to play. But I went to the meeting, I gave my name greeting, I saw you standing in the room. Your eyes were tied down and your body a crown on the temple of some kind of gloom. And your feet and your mind are just slipping away. And the heat of your body shape of a pair. Alcoholics
That was Nathan Roche from a brand new album. That song is called Alcoholics Anonymous. Matt Banham is filling in for AHK Lee this week. And we were just having a chat. That dude is so prolific.
He does too much. It wears me out just thinking about it.
Writes books, writes albums in a couple of months. Obviously still finds the time to get drunk all the time. Mm-hmm.
And then sing about it. It's beautiful. He's a beautiful man.
Talented dude. You're listening to Backchat on FBI Radio. It's time now for News in Brief. And I guess the big news this week is the government has figured out a way to save some cash on asylum seekers. They spend an absurd amount of cash on asylum seekers. Last year, offshore asylum seeker processing cost us $3.3 billion for 4,200 people. So that's about $800,000 per asylum seeker per year. I mean, you know, like we could just process them in the community.
We could build so many more dinosaur parks.
Well, the latest figures that we have for community detention are from 2011, because I figure that's the last time that we decided not to lock people up in Nauru. And that at that point, it was costing us around $10,000 per asylum seeker to process them onshore in the community, you know, not traumatizing them, not exposing them to risk of injury or death on Manus Island.
But if they're in the community, then Parramatta Road would get really packed, full of drivers, then I wouldn't be able to get to work on time. Isn't that the argument?
Look, it dumbfounds me. I'm really not sure after this long and after watching the news and listening to the arguments for this long, I'm really still not quite sure. I fundamentally don't understand it. But the important thing is that the government has figured out a way to save a bit of money, $100 million over 4 years, by denying asylum seekers access to free legal advice. Mm. So they figured out a way to save some cash. I mean, I figure like if we didn't abuse their human rights so much and if we didn't leak 10,000 of their personal details so that they had to file a suit against us and then spend $500 per asylum seeker moving them to WA the day before their court case, if we didn't spend all of that money, maybe they wouldn't actually need so much legal advice because they wouldn't be fighting for their basic human rights. Mm. And we could just save a little bit of cash that way.
I think you should submit this idea to the government, maybe to Joe Hockey or someone like that. Put it down in note form and maybe make a budget on Excel or something like that.
Yeah, I think that's how
Google,
they do it.
Do they have a Google Excel?
A Google Docs spreadsheet. I'll see if I figure out, Tony Abbott's password. It's probably Mission Accomplished or something like that. I'll get into their Google Docs and go, look, guys,
totally is.
I have figured it out. If you just stop terrorizing and demonizing these people, you can save about $2 billion. Yeah, I don't know. Now, in other news this week, Matt Gasco is taking a 17-year-old to ASIC, the Australian Securities and Investments Commission. She had a bit of an adventurous April Fool's joke that went kind of wrong. She sent an email. This is up in the Northern Rivers region where Matt Gasco has been quite high profile. There's been a lot of protests against their mining exploration and it's near where they're blockading the lead forest as well. And basically she sent this email out saying Matt Gasco has ceased all operations in the Northern Rivers region and actually what they're going to do is build a solar thermal plant at Casino instead, which I thought was pretty badass.
Mm.
But she sent it from her school email address, so it was clearly a hoax. But these guys have referred her to ASIC, where she can be charged for fraud, which will cost her up to $750,000.
Hopefully the judge has a sense of humour.
Or 10 years in jail. I know, hopefully he has a sense of humour. But what's really interesting about that is there is this precedent where last year on April Fool's Day, another guy did this to Whitehaven, and they were saying it temporarily wiped $350 million off their share price. Which again just demonstrates to me that I obviously don't understand how financial markets work, because it's just pretend money, you got it back.
And is he getting in trouble?
Yes, he's getting in lots and lots and lots of trouble with ASIC. Now, another dude who is getting in lots of trouble in relation to mining is a 92-year-old blind Kokoda veteran who got arrested this week. I just think he's such a total badass.
Yeah, he's pretty cool. But he got arrested as well, right?
He got arrested for blockading the lead forest. And the news articles were really, really funny. One bit in there was saying, you know, his name is Bill Ryan, and it says, Ryan is understood to be sitting in the shade waiting to be processed by police. Like, they just don't know what to do with him. Because normally, if you've got a protester who's locking themselves to a gate or a tree or whatever like that, you know, you rough them up a little bit and you drag them out. But, like, I think obviously somebody drew the line there and went, you know what, he's 92 and he's blind and he's really old and he fought for this country in the Second World War. We'll at least let him sit in the shade while we're arresting him.
There's not much spin that they could put on put on a 92-year-old man to make him seem like an evil person that they should beat up.
You would have to
protest.
You would have to try pretty hard. Now, the other really, really hilarious news this week, of course, WA is going to the polls today. Mm. Scott Ludlam is now a household name, or at least like people on the internet love him.
They do. And but for some reason, the Labor's candidate for today's election, Joe Bullock has, has basically said that nobody should vote for Labor, and he doesn't like Kevin Rudd, he didn't like Kevin Rudd.
Which, irrelevant, man. Like, yeah. Can we stop talking about Kevin Rudd? Like, are we done?
But, so maybe maybe Clive Palmer should just take his votes, because he really wants to do well.
Well, what I really don't understand is how the hell this guy got endorsed. Because he's come out and said, like, oh, well, you know, there's a good chance that Labor will get elected, so you may as well elect me. But he's come out and said he thinks that Tony Abbott has good core beliefs and could potentially be a very good prime minister. And it's like, well, firstly, he is the prime minister, so, like, well done there, mate. But I just don't understand how he got endorsed, or how someone somewhere along the line in West Australian Labor did not pick this guy up and go, hang on, mate, where are you actually coming from? Like, which party do you belong to? Like, has anyone checked his membership?
It sounds like he was woken up and just started talking, maybe. That's the excuse I'm going to give him.
I've got no idea. Anyway, good luck today in the polls, WA. We'll be keeping a close eye on that and seeing how it goes. You have been listening to Backchat on FBI Radio. This is Black Vanilla. Call your husband.
Shit.
That one was Black Vanilla, Call Your Husband. You've been listening to Backchat on FBI Radio.
And this is the end. This is the end. Thanks so much for having me. It's been fun.
That's Matt Bannett. We had a text in actually.
Fun and depressing.
Yeah, we have 0409-945-945. Someone's texted in just saying, Matt Banham's on the radio. Yay!
Yeah, thanks, Mum.
It's all right. Kaylee's dad texts in every week.
Yeah.
I think my folks have texted in once.
Oh.
Yeah. I had some significant political contributions about the fact that they were having cake on the front deck. It was great. My name's Heidi Pett. Matt Bannum filling in for AH Kaylee this week. And big thanks to James Colley, Bart Denaro, and our wonderful producer, Andrew Rhodes, for their help with this program. Backchat is produced with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Until next time, Lexi Savides is up next with the weekend lunch. What do you got for us?
Well, if I knew that I could win your affections by bringing cake, then you should have told me. I would have brought you a homemade cake.
You can win anyone's affections by bringing cake. That's just like the standard rules of human interaction.
I guess so, unless you're gluten intolerant. Then you have to tell me dietary restrictions and all. Moving on from food, though, even though it is lunchtime, I've got Courtney Barnett, brand new Oscar key song, Holiday Sidewinder, so much more to play for you this next 3 hours, so I hope you can stick around.
That Holiday Sidewinder tune has been stuck in my head for about 3 days.
It's a catchy one, isn't it?
It is a real catchy one. What's up first?
I'm going to start off by playing a bit of a slow burner. This one is from a New Zealand group called Yumi Zuma, and they did a cover of an Air France song called It Feels Good to Be Around You.
Dear Air France, sometimes I think the way we met happened too fast. I remember lying in spiky grass, falling asleep in the shade, waking up to city sounds. But I'll always think about you.